I think they're done now. The suite number one in the key of C, Johann Rosenmüller's music, played by Hesperian 20, and they were led by their founder and longtime conductor, Jordi Savall. I'm Lynn Warfel, glad you could be with me for the music.
89.3 FM, WHFR Dearborn. That's the station that you're listening to, and we're so glad you're there. Good day. I'm Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager. It is a pleasure to welcome you to our airwaves. If you've got a business or an organization and you would like to get the word out in a more in-depth way, particularly during these challenging economic times, well, WHFR underwriting or sponsorship might just be the thing for you. It is a very cost-effective way to get the word out about your business or organization to wonderful listeners. Listeners that support the independent alternative programming here at WHFR and are very loyal and very receptive to what we do. If you'd like to learn more about how cost-effective underwriting can be and how it truly supports this station here at WHFR, we would love to talk with you. Give me a call, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
To Are We Alone? Robot technology has come a long way, folks. Today's automatons can vacuum
your... Wait. Seth, we already did that show.
What?
We did that show, How Robots Are on the Move. We've done it.
Wait, what's this show about here?
Well, we've all had cognitive mishaps, forgetting where you left the keys, the wallet, the glasses, the remote control, the iPod, the cell phone...
Or walking out of the house wearing nothing but tangerine-colored cellophane, a Spider-Man mask, and flippers.
Right. Brain function changes in different ways as we get older. Memory begins to slip, and so apparently can other forms of judgment. I'm Molly Bentley.
And I'm Seth Shostak. But all is not lost, with the exception of your keys, your wallet, your glasses, and about a million socks. It turns out that your brain is more adaptable and capable of reprogramming itself than once thought.
It's the science of neuroplasticity. Hey, just trying to say that word has already strengthened my synapses.
Find out what you can do to put the brakes on cerebral slide. Also, brain gyms. They're the new trend. But do they really work?
Plus, does your brain operate at the power level of an idling automobile, a laptop computer, or a refrigerator light? Answers later on.
Oh, and if you're looking for your cell phone, have you checked the freezer?
Neuroplasticity. The word doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but still it's uttered a lot these days. That's because for a long time we thought the brain was hardwired, fixed, immutable. Only children had brains that could change and grow. But scientists have now discovered that the silver-haired have improvable brains, too. Neuroplasticity has grabbed the attention of science reporter Gordy Slack, who's been writing about current brain research for a number of magazines. He, in turn, has interviewed Michael Merznick, a leading figure in brain plasticity research for more than three decades. We decided to grab them both.
Mike, neuroplasticity, the idea that our brains might not be kind of frozen in place like bowling balls or something. How do we know that our brains are more plastic than neuroscientists once thought?
Well, there are thousands and thousands of experiments that demonstrate that fact, that by which scientists witness the brain changing as you learn or acquire skills or abilities or improve what you're up to. So the brain actually, unlike a computer or any other machine you know about, actually changes itself in detail. What it's doing is changing the details of its connections as you acquire skill and ability.
So it's kind of rewiring itself?
Yeah, well, it's in detail. It's basically forming new connections, losing connections. It's specializing. It's basically each time you acquire an ability, the machinery actually changes, and those changes account for that acquisition of ability.
Can you briefly give me an example of the kind of experiment that would be done that would show that?
Well, you could train yourself, or you could train an animal to acquire a new skill or ability, something it can do tomorrow that it's not able to do today. And as it acquires that ability, you can actually witness the brain change physically, functionally. And you can see it, in a sense, specialize in ways that are required for the command of that new skill.
But that sounds to me like learning. We all know that we can learn things, but rewiring the brain sounds like you're actually changing the hardware and the software.
Right. Well, what we haven't actually understood, the classical view was that the brain was like a machine, like a computer, that had fixed connections in which the neurons had established interconnectivities, and then we had to invoke sort of mysterious algorithms in our computer in order to account for the acquisition of ability. But we now understand that the brain is actually changing itself. It's actually modifying itself. And the understanding that we actually have the capacity to change this machinery for the good at any point in life, that we have this great asset, you know, is really a new awakening.
Let me get Gordy in here. Gordy, you're writing a story about neuroplasticity for the San Francisco Magazine, I think it's called. Other than Dr. Mesenick's work, what else are you looking at here?
Well, I've been spending a lot of time at the Keck Center for Integrative Neuroscience at UCSF, where Mike works. And among other things, I'm looking at two scientists there who are studying finches, birds, and how they acquire their songs as babies, and how their brains keep those songs tuned up as the birds age, as their bodies change, and as the world changes around them. People had thought in the old model that after a critical early period, those vocalizations that the birds learn sort of crystallize into unchanging songs. But as it turns out, birds can change their songs a lot, and their brains are very plastic too, and work as pretty good models for human brains.
So was this a surprise? I mean, neuroplasticity seems to be a surprise even for humans. I can imagine it would be even a greater surprise for bird brains.
Yeah, it certainly surprised me, and I think it surprised scientists early on, too, that bird brains can actually be sort of loosened up, and under the right conditions, they can rewire, too. And I guess if you can teach old birds new songs, you can teach old people new songs, too, which is what their research is kind of driving at.
Well, speaking of old birds being taught new songs, Mike, you know, if the brains are naturally plastic and evolution has made them so, why does mine seem to be getting worse as I get older? That sounds maladaptive.
Well, it has something to do with how you're using it. So maybe if you used it a little bit more vigorously and maybe a little bit closer to the natural way that humans were set up to use their brains, you know, those changes might be a little slower. Because one of the things that happens in early life is that, you know, it's all about learning. We're acquiring the skills and abilities that we use that dominate our life, our older and adult life. And then we become users of mastered skills and abilities in a modern life and modern culture. And we're not learning on the schedule that might be natural to the human species, where we had to be more continuously adaptive, where life was more continuously a struggle. In any event, because the schedules of our learning in older life are substantially reduced, the learning machinery in our brain is actually significantly downregulated in older age. So learning rates are slower. We actually learn more slowly. We acquire ability with less facility. But it turns out that machinery is also plastic. And we can also increase the rates at which we can learn or acquire new ability again by appropriately exercising it. And when the conditions are right, when it really matters to us, when it really matters to our brains, we can learn effectively at any age.
But I would imagine that from evolution's point of view, if you live to 30, right, and you're still alive at 30, I mean, you know, going back 100,000 years now, not in the modern world, but when our brains actually got wired up, 100,000 years ago, if you lived to 30, nature might figure, hey, look, whatever this person is doing has survival value. They've made it this far. We're not going to change it now. We're going to hardwire that in, and plasticity might actually reduce your survival rate.
Well, I think that there's obviously value in a social animal like humans for surviving elders. And one of the really interesting things about humans is that we continue to acquire knowledge, you know, at older age, even while our learning rates may be declining. And knowledge in a small group, in a small society, in a social species is incredibly valuable. So basically older individuals, the elders in communities, have always had great value and presumably contribute to the survival of the group and therefore to the survival of the species.
Gordy, you've said that there are cultural ramifications of this scientific revolution, if you will, and Mike has just alluded to one, that you know, seniors are not just sort of a drain on society, they're actually a benefit. How does our brains being plastic matter beyond medical and scientific applications?
Well, it really contradicts this old idea of the person as a computer-like machine that's hardwired and just runs its applications. There really is not a clear distinction, I'd say, between the applications themselves and the hardware. So there's a very different model of what a human brain is and what it even is to be a human being in general. We're clearly still machines, but we're not like any other machines around today, certainly not like the computers we've got. and we're constantly changing ourselves, not just updating our data or our information, but adjusting the very ways that we process it. So, among other things, we sort of have a new concept of what it is to be a human being.
Well, you're writing an article about this, and presumably part of the appeal of the article is that this is news to many people out there. Is that what you're finding, that most people think that their brains are solidified and, hey, here's good news for you. You can put it on a treadmill and maybe improve it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think most of us have this idea that we're born, our brains kind of improve and solidify and quicken until we get to be in our 20s. And then from then on, it's all sort of downhill. And the best you can do is kind of put up dikes here and there and put Band-Aids here and there. But the fact that our brains are much more changeable and that we can influence the ways that they change is a profound discovery, but it's one that's being very slowly, I think, absorbed both by the scientific world and also by the broader cultural world. It has profound ramifications in the areas of education and in philosophy and in many other areas, including maybe computer design. People have always used the brain as kind of a model for how to design computers, and I think maybe this new model of the brain suggests that maybe computers could also learn to be, or we could design them so that they also adapted as the conditions around them change.
Well, in the last few decades, it's become very fashionable in a way that I don't think it was before for people to train their bodies or at least exercise their bodies, try and keep them in shape. It's, you know, all sorts of studies show the benefit of that. So, you know, are the young folk going to be going to mental gymnasia? Are they going to be trying to train their brains at home? What's going to happen socially?
Well, they're going to realize that it matters, that what they do matters, that they're, in a sense, they're in charge of their performance abilities and how they advance or don't advance. And also the appreciation that it's not just your operational abilities that come out of these plastic processes, but also the very person you are, in a sense, is a creation of these processes in your lifetime. And the quality of that person, the quality of that person as an operating individual in the world, is basically under the control of the operator, that is to say you, and how you use this machine and basically nurture and grow and drive it. And it provides you with the potential to continue to grow and elaborate it and, in a sense, make it more useful and effective to the end of your life.
How can I upgrade my brain? Suppose I'm over 30. 30's way back there somewhere. I'm over 30. You know, I want to improve my mental capabilities. I want to get more out of life by seeing more of life going by and doing more that's creative. And so how do I exercise my brain, Mike? What do I do?
Well, first of all, it's not achieved trivially. You know, it takes a significant level of exercise, significant level of engagement to actually drive it to a new and more powerful or more effective position. But basically, you can improve at almost every elemental skill and ability that controls your operations in the world. So you can improve in the accuracy with which you take in information and can record it and remember it and use it and control your actions on the basis of that information and the analysis of that information. All of these abilities are acquired and refined through brain change, through exercising the brain in a heavy and continuous way.
And you, Gordy, after having done the research for your article, are you also engaged in a little bit of exercises for your cerebellum and cerebrum and whatever other part of your anatomy up there that you think ought to be improved?
Well, I'm not sure where the salsa center of the brain is, but I have started taking salsa lessons, which I'm hoping might improve my brain a little bit. And I've also, on Mike's advice, started walking barefoot as much as possible, because apparently the information that you get through the bottoms of your feet keep parts of your brain, including the balanced parts of your brain, tuned up in a way that they aren't kept intact otherwise. So salsa and barefoot walking, so far, those are...
and move right up to the samba.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen, so much for talking with me today, and I hope to see the improvement in my own brain. I'm going to go home and work some Sudoku. Mike Mezenich, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Gordy Slack, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you, Seth.
Michael Merznick has been a leading researcher in brain plasticity research for more than 30 years. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and professor emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco. Gordy Slack is a science reporter in California. He's written about brain research for Salon.com, San Francisco Magazine, and New Scientist.
Coming up, practical tips for keeping your noggin in top form. Ever heard of a brain gym?
It's Are We Alone?
Here's an idea that will keep your neurons knocking and your synapses snapping. Become a Team SETI member and support the SETI Institute. When you become a Team SETI member, you'll make possible the work of scientists who investigate the nature of life on this planet and how we might find it elsewhere. Send an email to us telling us that you listen to the show when you do join, and you'll receive an 8x10 glossy photograph of a team whose brains really do need more exercise. Gary, Barbara, Molly, and me. Perfect for protecting your coiffure from pigeons or lining the barbecue pit during cookouts. If I could only remember where I put the charcoal. So make a note, go to radio.seti.org and join the team.
We all know that going to the gym improves our physical fitness. It builds endurance, strengthens muscles, improves blood flow. In other words, the workout keeps us younger. Well, the mindset that has millions of people flexing their biceps and stomach crunching their way through their lunch hour may one day have them doing the same for their brains. At least that's the idea behind Vibrant Brains, believed to be the first brain gym in the country. Vibrant Brains welcomes fee-paying members to give their gray matter a workout. It opened its doors in San Francisco in December 2007, and we had just the guy to send their way.
Here I am in the Presidio Heights section of San Francisco. Mix of shops, houses, but I'm looking for a gym. Oh, wait a minute. Here's a gym, but wrong kind. They're in there with their ellipticals. They're all sweaty, and they don't look like they're enjoying themselves. I'm looking for a different kind of gym here, one that can give my cerebellum a workout, you know, kind of tune me up mentally. Let's see. Molly gave me an address here, and... Oh, no, wait a minute. This is it right here. Vibrant Brains. Sounds right, except my brain isn't quite vibrant enough, but I hope they're going to be able to fix that. I'll just step inside here. Oh, hi. My name is Seth.
Hi, Seth. I'm Jan Zivic, one of the founders of Vibrant Brains.
Jan?
Hi, Seth. I'm Lisa Schoonerman, the other founder. Nice to meet you.
Well, it's very nice to meet both of you ladies. I'm actually here to see about getting my brain tuned up because it seems to be misfiring on a few cylinders. Can you really actually help me with that?
Well, we have a lot of exercises, Seth, that will help exercise all your cognitive functions, everything from your memory to your visual spatial skills, all kinds of things that will help sharpen you up in no time.
And is this something that I'll notice right away, or is this going to be a long program? Am I going to be coming back here, you know, three times a week for the next 5 years?
Well, you know, if you go to the gym and work out one day and you haven't worked out in 10 years, you're not going to see a big difference right away. But if you go back to the gym consistently and work out, say, half hour a day, you will begin to notice a difference quickly. And the same thing is true here. The scientists who have developed these programs suggest you work on them minimum of 3 days a week.
Well, as I look around here, I don't see the usual gymnasium equipment, of course, and I don't even see little tiny treadmills that I could put my brain on. What I see are a lot of black desks arranged around the room, and each one has a monitor on top, and there's a chair. I mean, it looks like a computer training class or something like that.
Not all, but most of the programs we have are done on computers. The gym idea is not a tiny treadmill for your tiny brain, Seth, but a big computer.
That could be really
small. A big computer, because your brain can, we have discovered, learn new tricks. You can learn new tricks. You can create new connectors. You can create new brain cells. And these programs on these computers will help you do that.
Well, I'm a little keen to see what you can do to make my brain a little bit more supple, because I think it has all the suppleness of a diamond lattice or something. What do I have to do here? Do I just...
Sure, Seth. Let's fire up a machine and get things going.
What you see is 20 exactly the same computers, but on the computers are different programs. And what we have developed at Vibrant Brains is what we call the neurobic circuit training. And the programs cover every part of the brain. So if you actually do the neurobic circuit training, you will have exercised all parts of your brain, which is important.
Okay, well then I'll just sit down here. Is this okay, Lisa, if
Absolutely.
I just take this chair?
Absolutely. Have a seat. Seth, we're assuming you're right-handed here. I don't know if
I am right-handed.
Okay.
Yes.
Good guess.
Okay.
If you feel like you want to sharpen up a little bit, maybe work on your processing speed today, word bubbles is a popular exercise here. And that, as it says on the screen, is designed to train and improve your processing speed by targeting verbal fluency. Essentially, what you're doing is being timed and challenged to come up with as many words as you can think of that begin with three letters that they'll give you.
Okay, well, that sounds like something that would be useful for me to improve my verbal fluency.
So whenever you click start on the screen, Seth, then it'll tell you what your three letters are, and then you can begin.
Okay, this is better than Sudoku on the airplane. Just a minute. All right, here we go. Word bubbles, start. Okay, so the deal here is it's giving me the first three letters. It wants me to complete those with words, and words of four letter, five, six, seven, all the way up to, you know, endless. And I'm supposed to get a kind of an even distribution. I mean, I can't just pick all three-letter words, four-letter
exactly,
words.
Exactly.
Okay, so words starting with sig. Okay. Sign, signature, signify, signal, sigh, how about S-I-G-H, sight, S-I-G-H-T, significant, let's see,
suffixes, Seth, if you know, it's kind of cheating, but it...
Well, signification, yeah, signage, of course, and signing, as in signing a letter, and sightings, as in UFOs, and, I've got 11 more seconds. Let me think about another one. Gee, this is tough. My brain is, it's frozen up. It's hit the Arctic tundra. That's it. End of, doggone. It says, trade in your brain now. Special offer. Okay. It says my score is 720. Is that out of 100,000? What is that?
It's really not out of something, but I can tell you by people who walk in here and do demos, that's very good. But more important than my opinion is the fact that once you sign up for these programs, they will register what you have done, and each program will assess and make the programs, the games within the programs, more difficult, more complex, in less time, et cetera. So the better you are, the harder it gets, because research has proven that you can't stretch your brain by doing the same old thing.
I've done something for my processing speed. I guess I've gone from, you know, a 1 gigahertz processor to a 1.2 gigahertz, maybe 1.01 gigahertz processor. But, you know, my real problem is memory. At least that's what I recall, and not very well. Is there something here? Oh, Monster Garden. All right, play now. Area of cognition, memory. Improves your memory and attention with a spatial memory test. Sounds like something for me. Is that for me, Lisa?
I think so, Seth. Let's give it a whirl.
Okay, all right. I'm just going to click here.
What you'll be doing with this exercise is you'll see a little garden space with a farmer, but monsters pop up. So you need to keep track of those and then tell the computer where you saw them.
All right, so it's got a sort of a grid up there, a 4x4 grid, and monsters appear in one or the other of the spaces in the grid, and then they disappear. So I have to sort of keep mental track of where they've been, and then I have to sketch out a path through this grid for that little farmer guy to get over to the flowers, another part of the grid. So it's, in other words, it's kind of remembering where the impediments, where the, you know, the barriers are. So it's the test of memory and, to some extent, being able to choose a path, I suppose. Okay. So, there's a monster popping up there. Another monster pops up. A third monster. Nope. Only two monsters have popped up. And now I have to get the farmer over to the flower by avoiding the monsters. Okay. And the monsters are, I think, here and there. Okay. Oh, I got that right. But that was an easy one, I have to say. These guys weren't too tough.
If you go to the next level, for example, Seth, next time you log in, you start at that level. So you're continually challenging yourself.
Yeah, this sounds like the wrong philosophy. If I do well, then they make it harder. I mean, you'd think that if you did well, they'd make it easier for you. Some sort of reward. I don't know. It's like, you know, getting the dolphin to jump up and then you give him fewer fish. And what about cost? I have to ask you that. I mean, people can either come here and buy the software, take it home and use it there if they do, or they can, you know, come here and join with others and do the exercises sort of in a social environment. Is it more costly than going to the gym three times a week? Less costly?
Yeah, I think it is comparable to going to a gym from a financial perspective. you know, people make personal choices about how they use their disposable income, and we are certainly in it for 1 month. A 1 month membership at Vibrant Brains is less than a nice meal, for example, or maybe a couple of shows at the cinema.
Jan, you founded this business for reasons that go beyond, well, this is something the world could use, or this may be a way to pay for the groceries or anything like that. I mean, you had real direct experience here.
Yeah, Seth, about 10 years ago, I was in an automobile accident and had brain surgery, went into a coma, and came out of it pretty much having lost my left side and what we refer to as executive skills, memory organization, processing speed, some of the things we've talked about today. And 10 years ago, these programs were not available, or they were only available to doctors who were still experimenting with them. So most of what I did was manual. It took me more than 6 years to get to a point where I could go back out in the environments that I was accustomed to being in and be comfortable. And it was because of these kinds of exercises and working with a speech therapist, working with an occupational therapist, etc., that years of practice and exercise helped me get back to what one would perceive as normal.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't possibly guess that there was ever anything wrong with your brain.
Actually, the process of doing things, remembering things, doing things that are detailed and challenging, you know, I'm not back to where I was, but I have vastly improved.
But I want to thank you both for taking on what I consider a very considerable challenge, that is trying to improve what passes for my brain.
It's been our pleasure, Seth.
We're happy to have you and happy to see you've improved already.
Well, as I step back outside here into the streets of San Francisco, I feel like, you know, I went in a Peugeot and I came out a Maserati, mentally speaking. I think I'm ready to take on the nuances of string theory now, maybe just the theory of everything. Maybe I'll work on that for a while. If only I could remember where I parked my car.
Do you find it difficult to find the time to work out? Does the price of a gym membership seem too expensive? Don't let these reasons get in the way of exercising. Try the Henry Ford Community College Fitness Center. The HFCC Fitness Center is conveniently located on campus in the Athletic Memorial Building. Drop in between classes or before you go home for the day. You'll save valuable time because you won't have to commute to a gym. And the best part is that use of the fitness center is free to HFCC students. Students should bring their student ID for access. Lockers are available for no charge, but you must provide your own lock. Come and work out at the HFCC Fitness Center.
Listen, was that you?
Are you looking for a real degree that's going to prepare you for the future? Then listen up. 2009 not only marks the 70th anniversary of Henry Ford Community College, but it also marks the beginning of a brand new degree program here at HFCC. The Alternative Energy Technology degree is great for students looking to prepare themselves for a career in a new generation of green jobs. Students will learn about renewable energy and promoting and practicing of energy efficiency. If you're interested in more information about this degree or any of the other degrees here at HFCC, please call 1-800-585-HFCC or visit them online at www.hfcc.edu.
Hey, this is the Gothabilly Man, your friendly neighborhood beatnik, inviting you to join me for the Wrecking Hours Rockabilly Segabilly Radio Show every Monday from 4 to 6 p.m. on the station Making Waves, 89.3, bringing to you unique radio since 1985. It's WHFR.FM.
Yeah. That's right. Sing along to all your old favorite songs from the Big Band era with me, Dan. I host Big Band with Dan every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. right here on the only station that's making waves, WHFR 89.3 on your FM dial. And remember, sing, sing, sing.
People can eat with
challenging.
Well, the scientists...
What researchers are saying about these brain gyms and whether there are other things we could do to improve our cognitive capacity. Gordy, what do scientists make of brain gyms? I mean, is there any evidence that it works?
Well, the scientists that I talk to for the story that I'm writing on neuroplasticity were skeptical, I think, about brain gyms. They're not against it in principle. And I think they think it's good if it motivates people and gets people actually trying new things, doing other things that are good for their brains. But I don't think any of them go to brain gyms, I'll tell you that. And I don't think that they're expecting miracles from them.
Well, what do the scientists recommend that we do to improve our brains, if anything, other than getting born again, maybe?
Well, the neuroscientists at UCSF Keck Center for Neuroscience, which is where I focused my story, they all said that they thought that doing neuroscience was really good for the brain, which I believe because, you know, they're always having to wrap their minds around new ways of looking at things, and it's a pretty challenging field. But then they also gave the basics. It's important to get a lot of physical exercise, especially aerobic exercise, which is great for your brain because it brings oxygen there, and apparently it also makes your hypothalamus a little bit bigger, more robust, good for your memory. It's probably as good or better than any other brain exercises we know. They also say that sleep is key and good nutrition is also important. Adam Ghazali, a really hotshot MD, PhD at UCSF, said that he eats antioxidants and vitamin E and omega-3s all for his brain.
What about blueberries or walnuts? Because we've seen those.
Blueberries and walnuts are excellent, partly because they have a lot of antioxidants.
Okay, so it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is just do things that make you healthy overall. Is that really true, or is that just sort of, you know, apple pie and motherhood kind of advice? Because clearly if you die, you know, your brain isn't very good. But
yeah, no, I mean, I think those things are specifically good for your brain. But there are some plasticity-related things that these neuroscientists also suggest. And those have kind of an apple pie quality about them, too, to be perfectly honest. They say it's really important to try new things. Don't just do the same old hard things over and over again. Even if you're doing neuroscience, I guess, it's good to, or rocket science in your case, it's good to try new things. So, you know, try something that's outside your field. If you're used to doing crossword puzzles, try learning algebra or doing chemistry or playing Sudoku instead. New physical things are good for your brain, too. Take a tap dancing lesson if you already know how to salsa, or take salsa if you know how to tap dance, or start playing curling or whatever that sport is called, or some other sport that's totally new to you. Again, it's really important in getting the right neuromodulators secreting in your brain to be challenging yourself in new areas.
Let me follow up on that a little bit, because it sounds like what you're suggesting is that, you know, continuing to do, say, Sudoku or crossword puzzles and doing harder and harder ones isn't as valuable as switching gears entirely and doing something completely different.
That's exactly right. Go ahead, keep doing crossword puzzles if they make you happy, but they're not really going to push your brain in the way that these neuroplasticians are talking about. They need you to do things that are beyond your comfort zone, and it's really brand new kinds of activities that push you to that place where your brain gets excited about making changes. And that is at the edge of the envelope. That's where the new connections are made, the new connections between neurons. And when you're pushing back at that edge, your brain gets engaged and ready to learn and remember and to learn how to remember. And those neuromodulators start flowing and things begin to click.
Gordy Slack, thank you so much.
Thank you, Seth.
Well, those are a lot of good tips for keeping your brain agile, Seth.
Well, I don't know, Molly. I suppose Gordy's right that I should, in fact, keep trying new mental exercises. But I admit I'm kind of keen on the possibilities of boosting my brain with an electronic workout. Ah, back on campus. You know, for years I've been afraid to venture back into the halls of academe. I mean, I always felt intimidated by all the brainy types you find here. But now, thanks to that online brain training program, well, I'm as sharp as an Italian suit. Oh, hey, one of those trendy coffee shops that's always a magnet for intelligentsia. I would never have ventured into one of these things in the past, but now... it's a thinker's paradise. Look at all these minds at work. It's cogitation on a grand scale. Oh, wait, that guy over there, what's he doing here? He looks like a bozo of the first water. Seems to be doodling stick figures and that tie-dye shirt. His eyes are glazed over like donuts. He's clearly out of his element in this high IQ establishment. I have just the thing for him. Hi there. Nice doodle. Is that a pumpkin and a man with an umbrella?
No. Well, it kind of looks like it could
be. Yeah. Well, do you mind if I ask you something?
Huh? Well, okay, I guess so.
Have you ever thought about what your life would be like if you only had more brain power? You know, if you were smarter?
Well, we all want to be smarter. I mean, it would help me figure out.
Yeah, right. You bet it would. You'd have lots of exciting opportunities. You'd probably fit in better here, too, frankly. Certainly those stick figures would come up a notch.
They do look like stick figures a little, don't they?
Yeah, well, look, it's simple. Anyone can better their brain through exercise. It's like getting six-pack abs. A little mental exercise can really pump up your IQ.
Well, why not? I have a little free time.
I'm sure you do. Here, let me log you onto my laptop. Look, here's the site. I'm going to go get a double latte mocha vanilla java for the price of a small sedan and allow you to just stretch your cerebellum with these exercises right here on the screen.
Okay, I see how this is done.
Yeah, you do seem to be getting the hang of it. Okay, well, give that brain of yours a good workout. Boy, the java juice in this place is great. So, how did you do? Did you finish the brain training?
Yeah, I think I completed all the exercises.
Well, let's find out if you're cogitating on a higher level, shall we? I mean, tell me what you're thinking right now, okay?
Thinking? Well, I was just contemplating the effects of pressure-induced line-broadening mechanisms on the forbidden triply ionized transitions of monatomic carbon, stratified in the atmospheres of peculiar A-type stars.
Really? The ion trend, mono...
But what's really interesting is that the curve of growth will likely saturate at an equivalent width of 2 angstroms.
Wow, that actually sounds smart.
Well, it's just a little idea that I was...
Well, the mental gymnastics really improved your brain, I guess. I thought they might, but I wasn't sure, although they produce results much faster than I imagined. But, so there you are. We've given you the mental machinery of an egghead, and... No, you can thank me later. Hey, look, there's the parking guy outside. Gotta go feed the meter. Back in a sec.
Good morning, Professor Leibowitz.
Good morning, Professor Armstrong.
I'm looking forward to your talk this afternoon, a new approach on making Feynman diagrams.
Yes, I was just sketching some of them out this morning. I think we can check the supersymmetric heavy axions with a simple little perturbation.
Well, the department is certainly eager to hear your results, as we always are. See you then.
Yes, goodbye.
Hi, I'm back. Anyhow, as I was saying, you've shown remarkable brain improvement. Yeah, stick with it, fella, and you might just make professor one day. But at least those doodles might come to look like real people.
Well, as it happens, I was thinking...
Oh, look at that poor guy over there with the long hair and the tweed jacket. He obviously needs my help. Gotta run. Hey, mister, have you ever wanted to be smarter?
Coming up, why London cabbies have bigger brains than your average tube driver, and other facts about that gray matter upstairs. It's Are We Alone?
Welcome back to Are We Alone? Well, the more that researchers learn about the human brain, the more it surprises them. Not the least, its ability to make new connections faster than Thanksgiving travelers at O'Hare Airport.
Yes, and we count on the brain every day, try to take it everywhere we go. But how well do we know it, really? Maybe it's time to say hello. Welcome to Your Brain is the title of a book co-authored by neuroscientist Sam Wang that serves as an introduction to our noggin. Dr. Wang began by giving Seth's brain, newly sharpened with all those cranium crunches, remember, a quiz.
Okay, let's see how you do on these questions. The first one is, your brain uses about as much energy as A, a refrigerator light, B, a laptop computer, C, an idling car, or D, a car moving down a freeway.
Well, it's clearly not the last two, because those are, you know, hundreds, thousands of watts. Your brain doesn't use that. My impression was it was always sort of like a 25-watt light bulb, so I'd I guess I'd go with a refrigerator light, A.
That is an excellent choice. I hope that you haven't been primed. The answer is refrigerator light, but it turns out that refrigerator lights come in a range, and the amount of power your brain uses is about 12 watts, so it's only on a par with the dimmest of bulbs.
Geez, I thought I was burning through the calories twice as fast for my brain. All right, what I got that one right.
You're using your calories really well.
Glad there's some efficiency there.
All right, let's try another one. Your friend is trying to tickle your belly. You can reduce the tickling sensation by A, putting your hand on his to follow the movement, B, biting your knuckles, C, tickling him back, or D, drinking a glass of water.
Geez, I would think that you'd want to do something to kind of distract your brain.
Okay.
Maybe tickling him back?
No. Although that, if you did it the right way, it might help. It turns out that you can diminish the tickling sensation by putting your hand on his to follow the movement.
You mean because there's no surprise there? What's the deal?
That's right. So tickling is fundamentally an act of sensory surprise, and your brain is always generating predictions about what a movement will feel like. And so doctors use this trick, putting the patient's hand on the doctor's hand, to generate a prediction that makes the person not feel the sensation quite as much. It's as if there's a volume control on how strong a sensation feels, and if you can fool your brain into thinking that it's generating the sensation, then the volume decreases.
Interesting. Well, I'll try that next time, although it might be considered rather forward.
Well, find someone cooperative and good-humored.
Okay.
All right, and here's the last question. Which of the following is the hardest thing your brain does? A, doing long division. B, looking at a photograph. C, playing chess. Or D, sleeping.
Well, I hope it's not sleeping. I mean, I don't know. I have to go with the obvious because it seems to me that it is obvious, playing chess.
Well, playing chess is difficult in the sense of requiring complex operations, but it turns out that there's a lot going on when you look at a simple photograph. And this has to do with the fact that your brain is extracting features from the visual scene and looking for color and form and so on. And in fact, vision occupies about one-third of your brain's total volume, visual functions. And so that's a very hard thing that your brain does.
You know, there's apparently a massive amount that the brain is forgetting, losing, if you will, all the time and on purpose. Is that right? Are we constantly losing stuff?
That's basically true. So there's a belief that people have that their brains are like computers, and maybe if your brain's like a computer, perhaps memory is like a hard drive. But that's not really true at all. Your brain is engaged moment to moment in the business of deciding what's important, what's not important, and constantly throwing away information. If you could imagine remembering every single thing you did today, every single letter or number you saw, every experience, it would be overwhelming. And so it's necessary for your brain to forget things that are unimportant. And it's a major function of our brains to tell us what's important from what's not important.
But is that space freed up for new memories, or is it just, you know, just overwritten and never used again?
Well, it's not exactly known how memories are written into the brain, so that's a hard one to answer. But there does appear to be overlap in the sense that a piece of brain tissue can be used to store different kinds of facts and different kinds of information all within the same volume.
Now, maybe we should explain the title of your book, or at least you should explain what you mean by that. We forget where the car keys are, but we remember how to drive. I mean, if we're constantly losing memory, how come we don't lose the memory of how to drive?
Right. Well, the fundamental reason for this is that memory isn't one thing. Memory is about half a dozen different systems that our brain uses to remember things. And so the kind of learned skill that you've known for many years, such as driving a car, is written in a very long-term fashion in your brain, that includes many brain structures. Whereas where you left your keys is a more recently formed memory and is a specific spatial memory that's shorter lived. And that second kind of memory is one that tends to decline first. It declines surprisingly early in your 30s. And so there's a tendency to forget things like that, but it would be a very bad day when you forgot how to drive.
One of the intriguing things that I found in the book was your description of the London taxi drivers. They're very impressive because they've memorized all the twists and turns of London streets. And of course, that's a very old city, goes back to the Romans, and consequently, it has lots of twists and turns. And they have to, you know, learn all this stuff before they can drive a cab. Apparently, a study was done of these cabbies' brains, and they found something rather interesting. They weren't just your average brain. Isn't that true?
That's right. They have unusual structure in their hippocampus. The hippocampus is a structure that's important for remembering facts and also places. And so these memories that we talked about before about declarative facts, such as where your keys are, that would be something that your hippocampus does. And in general, your hippocampus is very important for not only memory, but also spatial navigation. What was found was that the posterior, the back part of these drivers' hippocampuses, were on average 7% larger than a non-driver's, and the anterior part was a little bit smaller. about 15% smaller. And so there's a difference in the structure of their hippocampuses from non-drivers. And the more years of experience they had, the larger this difference was.
Well, that last statement suggests that it wasn't that these drivers were being selected because by chance they had the correct kind of brain to memorize the street map of London, but that they could actually change their brain?
That's right. The way to think about it is this. All experiences that cause us to learn lead to structural changes in the brain. And so, for instance, if I remember that my car is parked around the corner and I remember that, that leads to something being set down in my brain. And what these people have done is study on an average of 2 years to memorize the street layout of London, and then they drive for sometimes decades longer. And all that experience and all that learning over time leads to structural changes that are measurable by a brain scan in their hippocampuses.
Could you do this in general? Could I, for example, study Bulgarian or something, and could you use some sort of device, maybe a magnetic resonance imaging or something, and see an actual physical change in my brain from having done that?
That has been observed in a variety of tasks, but all the tasks are pretty difficult ones. So, for instance, it's been observed that professional musicians who study musical performance for a long time will have structural differences in parts of their brains. But probably most everyday learning experiences would be pretty hard to image. So, for instance, I don't think that it's been imaged whether people who can speak many languages have particularly different Broca's areas than people who cannot speak many languages.
Let's talk a little bit about aging, Sam, although I find it kind of a distressing subject myself. You write that by age six, nearly all of the neurons in our brain have been born, but clearly a six-year-old is not as intelligent in some way as a 30-year-old. So what's happening? What's making us intelligent? It's not creating more neurons. Is it just, you know, wiring them up?
Well, there's a lot of wiring. I mean, basically what happens in brain development is that earlier in life, brains generate new neurons. And as you said, by age six, most of those are born. But there's still brain growth that happens after that. And so there's both the formation of connections and also the retraction of connections. And even though a child's neurons have all been born, the brain still physically grows in mass. And as I indicated earlier, experience changes the brain. And so there's a constant writing of information and rewiring and rearrangement that happens throughout life. And that's basically what learning is. And it happens during development as well.
My goodness. Well, but it does turn out that older people use their brains differently. There was some article I saw in passing here in the past couple of weeks that suggested that when you got older, you really did get wiser. Is there some change in how you use your brain as you get older that changes the kinds of things you can do well, if there are any?
There are things that older people do better or don't show a decline in compared with younger people. So there are some functions that are well known to decline, such as memory function, which we've talked about a little bit.
I don't recall.
Well, we did, trust me. But older people are often good at dealing with negative emotions, and so, for instance, can shake off a negative emotion better. It's also been observed that when a task is very well practiced, if a person really knows the task, then that task will not decline in performance. And it's believed that with experience, we learn how to use our brains in different ways, and we learn different ways to get to the same place compared with when we were younger.
Well, what about, you know, sort of railing against this long, dark night for your brain, you know, using a brain gym? These places are growing in popularity, places where you get on a computer, you do brain exercise to improve your memory. Is this valid or is this snake oil?
I would be reluctant to call it either. What I would say is that these brain games, these brain exercises that have become very popular are very good at training certain things. So, for instance, many of them are very good at training reaction time, and so you react faster. And, of course, this is reinforcing because if you react faster, then you feel that you must be smarter. But generally, these exercises are good at training to that specific task. And so, for instance, if the exercise is remembering items on a list, then that may help you when you go grocery shopping, but it probably won't help you, say, with that chess problem. And so the tasks trained to by brain gyms and brain exercises tend to be fairly specific, and the effects tend to be kind of small. Small enough that they might, in fact, be hard to notice even after months of practice.
Oh, that's discouraging.
Well, there is a positive effect. It's just that it's not a big effect.
Yeah. Well, at least it's not a negative effect. I mean, maybe the thing is that it's prophylactic, that if you didn't do that, maybe things would be worse for you.
Well, what if I could tell you about something you could do that would lead to an effect three times larger?
Well, I'd say I'm ready for the infomercial. Tell me.
Okay, well, it doesn't involve spending money on software. It involves exercise. So it turns out that exercise is good for the brain and can prevent cognitive loss. And specifically, exercise of the type that happens in fitness training, the type that is good for your heart, is also good for your brain. And the effects are large and noticeable, and you will notice them.
So you're not talking about mental exercise. You're not talking about doing the time Sunday crossword puzzle.
No, I'm talking about getting on the treadmill and working up a sweat and getting your heart rate up.
You call this good news, right?
I'm sorry. But the bad part of this news is that you do have to haul yourself out and do those things. But the rule of thumb is that things that are good for your heart are generally good for your brain, and it probably has to do with blood flow. And so exercise gets blood flow better to your heart and also probably increases blood flow to the brain.
I'm talking with Sam Wang. He's the author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive, and other puzzles of everyday life. Sam, let's look a bit to the future here, at least to the kind of research that might tell us something about the future of our brains. It was recently reported that a monkey who was implanted with a chip was able to move a mechanical arm by thinking about it. He was doing it with its brain, even though it wasn't his arm. In fact, he came to regard the arm as its own, even licking it after he fed himself. How did that technology work? How did you get the info from the brain from the monkey to the arm?
In animal experiments, the way these technologies work is that electrodes are implanted into the brain usually. Sometimes brain activity is monitored from the outside. But what happens is that those patterns are measured and then turned into movement. And what these researchers did was they measured activity from the part of the brain that generates motor commands and used those to operate a mechanical arm. And this is a technology that's exciting and can potentially help people and has been under development for several decades now and has really been a very active area of research for the last 5 years.
Does this mean that there are, you know, specific spots on your brain? If you just put the electrodes here, we could somehow read people's thoughts?
Yes. First, as far as movement goes, you can certainly monitor the intention to move. So, for instance, there was a study done a few years ago in which tetraplegics, people who did not have any use of any limb, were put in a scanner and asked to think about moving their hands. And there was a part of the brain that corresponds to hand movement in the motor cortex that lit up on the scanner. And so that sort of thing is possible. It's also possible in a rudimentary sense to read people's thoughts. With some training, you can guess what someone is perceiving between two possible percepts in an illusion by looking at the patterns of brain activity. And so in a very limited sense, it's possible to know what people are thinking about.
Well, how far could this go? I mean, does this open up the possibility of cognitive enhancement in humans? If we know what the interface is, if we know something about, if you will, the USB port of your brain, that we could, you know, we could just put a chip in there to improve your memory, or just put the internet in your brain, you know, chips to help us learn French or Bulgarian. I mean, is this likely, or is this just never going to happen?
I would say that if such a thing ever happened, that would be a very long way off. So all of these programs and all these technical innovations work by monitoring brain activity and training the machine or tuning the machine to be good at detecting patterns in brain activity and converting those to something interpretable. And so mind reading is one thing, and I think at some level that's going to become better over time. But in terms of jacking in, a la Neuromancer, and putting in the French chip, I think that sort of thing is going to be a pretty long way off, if ever.
Well, then finally, Sam, there's something called the Flynn effect, and you describe it in your book, namely that IQ scores seem to improve with every generation. Now, that's surely not because we're evolving to be smarter. I mean, Darwinian evolution wouldn't improve things that quickly. You write that it's probably a nutritional, a cultural effect, something like that. But are we ever really going to become smarter? Will our 3-pound brains become 4-pound brains? Or are we just going to invent thinking machines long before that happens and make ourselves obsolete?
Well, I wouldn't discount the Flynn effect. I think the Flynn effect is one of the great insights in modern psychology and in education. The fact that environmental influences can be limiting in brain development, so much so that increases in IQ scores can be seen decade upon decade, several points per decade in developed countries. I think that's a huge potential for improvement in the human condition. Now, as far as biological evolution goes, going to the 4-pound brain, such things are possible, but that's going to take many generations. That kind of evolutionary change works by natural selection. It's going to be dozens to hundreds of generations before, say, changes of the DNA will be reflected in the size of the function of our brains. I think there's a huge amount of potential growth in terms of environmental influence and making better use of our brains through upbringing and nurturing. But biological evolution is going to take a while.
Sam Wang, thank you so much for really a brain-stretching, brain-exercising talk. I really appreciate you talking to me.
Brainstorming?
Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sam Wang is a neuroscientist at Princeton University and co-author of Welcome to Your Brain, Why You Lose Your Car Keys But Never Forget How to Drive and Other Puzzles of Everyday Life.
And that's it for the show. We're all the smarter because of it.
But we wouldn't be without the help of Gary Niederhoff and Barbara Vance.
Or the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which provides essential support. And the SETI Institute, whose mission is to look for advanced brain power elsewhere in the cosmos. So that's a wrap, Molly. We're out of here.
Okay, let me just grab these papers and we can go. Forgot my jacket. And my backpack.
At karaoke bar, Greg shows the telltale signs of being wasted. First off, he's in a karaoke bar. On stage, he can't read the lyrics on the monitor. Greg decides to freestyle rap.
It's easy to tell if you've had way too many to drive. But what if you've had just one too many to drive? Never underestimate just a few. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, the Ad Council, and this station.
This is DJ Nick Woodcrest, host of American Classics, Sunday afternoons from 3 to 5 p.m., only on this humble nonprofit radio station. I play everything from Duke Ellington and Jelly Roll Morton to the Velvet Underground and television. From Brazil to Canada, if it's profoundly North or South American, you can find it here on American Classics, Sunday afternoons, 3 to 5 p.m., only on WHFR Dearborn, 89.3 on your FM dial, the only station that would allow a show like this on the air, the greatest radio station in the world, the station making waves. Join me, won't you? And thank you.
And hello, hello to you. This is Lynn, your host of No Boys Allowed, heard right here on WHFR 89.3. That's No Boys Allowed, where we explore the music of female artists who sing, who act, who play musical instruments, who speak quotable quotes. You'll even hear a recipe you might just like. Tune in every Saturday afternoon from 1 until 3 for No Boys Allowed with your host, Lynn, right here on WHFR, the station making waves. Where's that measuring cup?
That's right, sing along to all your old favorite songs from the Big Band era with me, Dan. I host Big Band with Dan every Monday from 2 to 4 p.m. right here on the only station that's making waves, WHFR 89.3 on your FM dial. And remember, sing, sing, sing.
You may already know that Henry Ford Community College has been educating our local community for over 70 years. You may also already know that HFCC offers a job skills guarantee, a credit transfer guarantee, and even a tuition freeze guarantee. But did you know that the start of the second 8-week classes for the winter of 2009 is coming up on March 16th? If you haven't already signed up for a class or two, you should consider signing up for any of the 20 different 8-week classes available, including classes in Allied Health, Business and Management, Computer Applications, Hospitality, or even Nursing. There are even many telecommunication classes being offered, including TCM 189, which is a staff training class for WHFR. To find out more information on these classes and many more, visit www.hfcc.edu or call 1-800-585-HFCC. Henry Ford Community College, your best choice, guaranteed.
Do you find it difficult to find the time to work out? Does the price of a gym membership seem too expensive? Don't let these reasons get in the way of exercising. Try the Henry Ford Community College Fitness Center. The HFCC Fitness Center is conveniently located on campus in the Athletic Memorial Building. Drop in between classes or before you go home for the day. You'll save valuable time because you won't have to commute to a gym. And the best part is that use of the fitness center is free to HFCC students. Students should bring their student ID for access. Lockers are available for no charge, but you must provide your own lock. Come and work out at the HFCC Fitness Center.
Listen, was that you? Always on. If and when that's true, waiting stops within.
Well, howdy! Thanks for coming to Big Bubba's. We got a mess of used cars. What can we do for you?
We're looking for,
something cute.
Well, here's a beauty. A 99 model with a moonroof. As a bonus, we'll throw in a leaking gas tank. You could be driving and kaboom! Adds that zing of excitement.
You got any other cars?
Wouldn't it be great if you could be warned of life's risks? If you have diabetes, you can. There's a simple blood test called A1C that can help measure your risk of complications from diabetes. Why is it important? Because more than 600 people every day die from diabetes and its complications. If your A1C is above 7, your doctor can show you how to lower it. If you have diabetes, know your risk. Know your A1C. Ask your doctor, or for more information, go to www.diabetesa1c.org or call 1-877-TEST-A1C. Brought to you by the American Diabetes Association, Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation International, and the Ad Council.
Welcome to another edition of The Lost Highway. My name is Tom, and you are listening to